So this was just a tutorial that Sushi was asking for, sort of the basics of transport. So there's lots of people here who know much more about it than I do and work on it much harder. So it's really supposed to be just the basics so that we have landings. We were going to do this last week, but things got busy. Matthias complained there were too many talks on the schedule, so we had to bump it to this week. So, this is not a formal presentation, right? And it's completely non-comprehensive. You'll recognize that the topics I'll bring up are ones that interest me. So what we can cover, right? So I'm only going to talk about the electronic degrees of freedom. But Julia Galli, I think, is going to talk about thermal transport on Wednesday. And of course, there's lots of very interesting things, but we can't cover everything. I'm not going to talk about metal chains or carbon nanotubes. And the reason for that will become fairly simple. Basically, usually you get transmissions of about one per channel in these systems, and so they're not such a demanding test of your theory very often. And what really causes you trouble is molecular electronics with organics. And this whole game started, I can't remember when it was, the Reed and Tour experiment, 89 was it, or something? I don't know, 99. It was in the late 90s anyway, where they took a thiolated benzene and they did this break junction experiment, hopefully getting a thiolated benzene molecule between two gold electrodes and measuring its IV characteristic, right? And then lots and lots of theory followed from that, right? And here's a more modern version. There's an extremely good group at Karlsruhe, and they take the molecules and they cycle them many times. They do the IV characters very often and get statistics on these curves. But basically, this red line here is the current versus voltage curve, and then the blue line is the derivative of that, which is a little noisier. So why is it a difficult problem, right, for theory? Well, you need chemical type accuracy. I don't demand 1 kilocal per mole, but let's say what I call chemically useful accuracy. You have hundreds of atoms, not just the molecule in the center, but also you need to do a decent amount of the leads to do these calculations. So you need the kind of all the energetics of DFT in that sense. First, we had poorly characterized experiments. Now they're much improved. The idea was that you took 1,000 experiments, and if it showed up in 3 of them, you published one of those. Right. Now people do lots and lots of statistics and get much better results, as we'll see. And there's all sort of difficulties that we've been talking about in the meetings, especially last week, with merging theories, all show up basically in this one problem, as we'll see. So that's why it takes a while. So it's not a ground state problem in the sense that you want the IV characteristic, right? You want to run current through the state. Electrons are going from left to right. They're not just sitting there. And it's not a finite system. It's not a little molecule where you can just do the thing to death. But it's not bulk either. It's this narrow channel, which is atomically small channel. And the difficult regime, I put this up especially knowing that Franco would be here this morning, for DFT, right, is the strong correlated part, right? So this has been well known for decades in mesoscopic physics, right? People make these quantum dots, and they're basically in that kind of regime, and so the molecule, or in that case quantum dot, is weakly coupled to the leads, and you can get strong Coulomb blockade effects. An electron hops on and stops another electron from coming on. And you see this in terms of the statistics in these quantum dots. And one thing I want to recommend very highly is there's a great website called the NanoHub at Purdue. And Sucrio Data, you know, shames us all in terms of, I guess he has great resources, but he has his courses and his lectures and everything is up there as podcasts and so forth. And he gives really, really nice lectures about things. But the basic thing is he's using sort of things like rate equations and many body theory to describe what's going on. And that's, you know, reasonably appropriate in this more strongly correlated limit. And also, people often study these things with model Hamiltonians, like Hubbard models and so forth, one-dimensional chains, and probably many of us have heard recent talks by Christian Tigerson in Denmark, doing those kinds of calculations and then sort of comparing them to DFT-type results. But basically, all that stuff tends to be restricted to model Hamiltonians, which aren't going to tell you the things about where the atoms bind and the details of the occupied and unoccupied orbitals. On the other hand, you don't know how much of this you need to capture in order to make your DFT-type calculation work, right? So this is, and you know, when I started getting into it, well, about 10 years ago or so, 11 years ago, I started thinking about it, and when I first started talking to people about it, sort of there was this argument between the strongly correlated people and the DFT people, because DFT people were saying, well, we can do a first principles calculation, everything ought to be in there, and anybody with this strong correlation would say, well, where's your Coulomb blockade, right? Where did it go? And we'll see that it does go away by accident. Okay, so this standard approach developed after about 5 years, I guess. So after this retour experiment, Hong Guo at McGill University, I was one of the first people using Green's functions. And using Green's functions, you divide the problem into three regions, the left lead, the molecule, the right lead, and you couple them together. And we use Green's functions to do that. An alternative, technically an alternative approach was developed by basically Norton Lang, and then calculations for molecules were by Deventer and Pantelides and Lang, where they use scattering theory to calculate the steady state solution, but in principle this gives the same as this one, and people have checked that in the codes and find that that's true. Now there are many, many groups with various codes all over the world set up to do these calculations. I want to mention one famous Irishman, Stefano Sanvito, has a spintronics code, and Stefan Blume will talk about spintronics tomorrow, and Carsten Ulrich will talk about spin Coulomb drag, coupling the spin and charge in these freedom. No problems so far. Okay. So, in the standard approach, right, you apply the Landau formula. So, Rolf Landau wrote it down about 50 years ago. And you apply this to your ground state cone shell potential. You calculate the transmission as a function of energy. And what you really actually evaluate is the transmission at the Fermi energy. And this name, non-equilibrium Green's function, NEGF, I find highly misleading, because I think of non-equilibrium Green's functions in terms of Bain, Kadanoff, and so forth, and to treat the many-body aspects of the problem. And they don't use it to do that. So it's just ground state DFT for the cone channel potential and transmission through that. I mean, there are nasty, tricky bits about finding, you know, at a finite voltage, finding a well-behaved solution, because it isn't a ground state problem anymore. But other than that, it's just, that's important, but other than that, it's just, you're going through this cone channel potential. And we feel deeply that that can't be right, right? But it might be better than you think. Okay, so let's draw a picture. Some of the stuff I'll use is from a big review that I wrote with Roberto a year ago. It's on our website. It's in Journal of Physics C. Okay, so the idea is, so a way of thinking about this is, here's your molecule, and then this picture, I've imagined it being weakly coupled to the leads, so you have sort of barriers between the molecules and the leads. And so the levels in the molecule get broadened into resonances because they couple to the continuum and the leads. And then you can imagine I'll only look at the symmetric case, and you have two Fermi Cs on either side, and you apply a bias and it pushes one of them up. And so then it looks like this. If you're better at drawing, right, that delta V is supposed to match this here. You can calculate from the Landauer formula the current as a function of voltage by looking at the transmission through this region and multiplying it by the Fermi function. So we'll do things at zero temperature. So this difference here will only be non-zero in the region between the difference between the two chemical potentials. And this gives you the result, the right result for non-interacting particles, for sure. And if you calculate this as you push this Fermi level up, you will get a sudden increase in the current because this previously unoccupied orbital is going to get will be used to there'll be states that get you from here to here, and so you get a sudden rise in the current. And because this is a resonance, because it's got some finite width, it'll happen over some finite range. And then if you differentiate that curve, you'll see a sharp spike dIdV in the position where the unoccupied level is. And in the early days, there was sort of basic agreement. Sorry, this didn't come out too well. This is from January 2000. This is a dithiolated benzene between two jellium surfaces, but the principle is the right idea. And then one of these is the experiment. I guess this one with the noise, and then this is the calculation. And although you can't see it because the cut and paste didn't work so well, one of the basic problems that... So what you see is that the features look kind of okay, but you get peak-type features at finite voltages, if you look at the scale here, you find that this is in microamps, and this is in microamps too, but this is in hundreds of them, rather than fractions of a microamp. So what people found, and this is a picture looking at the density of states and the unoccupied level coming into that window and giving you this peak. So what people found was, well, it looked kind of right, but typically the order of magnitude was off by typically 2, about 100. And that has stayed that way for quite a long time. Everybody with me so far? No question? Okay. So basic questions we'll address today, right? How do we know, how steady current arises, right? This was one of the questions when I started that people were wondering about, and Stefan Kurt. I don't know if you probably won't talk about that, it's older stuff, but I'll mention it here. Show how this steady current arises. What is the exact Landauer formula for the interacting system? We'll see that that's still a little open. So if the standard model were true, are the standard functionals good enough, right? So many, many people around the world are running these DFT calculations with their favorite functional, whether it's LDA, GGA, or a hybrid. Could you reasonably expect them to give you an accurate answer if this model were correct? And then if we have time, we'll go on to some advanced questions. So in the limit of weak bias, is the standard model correct, right? When the bias, when the voltage difference between the leads gets very small, you can do basically Kubo response theory and look at what the right answer ought to be and see what's going to come out. Where do TD-DFT and time-dependent current DFT come in? The standard model has only got ground state DFT, right? And we all believe that you need to correct it. And what is the best approach to the general problem, right? We really are exploring. It's gotten quite active in the last few years, especially people doing more model-type systems to understand the physics, right? Basically, we don't really understand the physics very well, what works, what doesn't, at finite voltage. And so that's being explored at the moment. Quite a bunch. So how does the steady current arise, right? So here's a sort of problem, right? Because if the reservoirs were finite, and the potential step is applied and held constant, then there's no more time dependence, right? You turn on the electric field, turn it off, and then leave it on so you have a finite potential difference. But you're not in an eigenstate, and so if you have any finite calculation, things will oscillate forever. So you need infinite reservoirs so the electrons can pass through and never reflect, right? So you can show that if the reservoirs are truly infinite, then what happens is the electron can pass through and it never hits the opposite wall. It never comes back. And under those conditions, I think it was von Amblat and Stefanucci showed that for non-interacting electrons in certain conditions, you get a steady current. And then Stefan and what I'll refer to as the Europeans, five things, right, as I always do, show that they did calculations, one-dimensional non-interacting calculations, but you get the Landauer result. But this was something that was kind of quite confusing at the time. But one thing that's interesting about that, of course, is that it means that the infinite nature of the electrodes needs to be, in some sense, taken into account. What is the exact Landauer formula in this case, right? So as I mentioned, you can show it's correct for non-interacting problems, and that should be, I don't know what that N bias is, it's correct for non-interacting problems. And in the zero bias limit, Landauer gets the Harkin corrections right, but not the exchange correlation. We'll get to that. So many people cite this Mayer-Wingreen paper, I think it was the right year, I'm not sure, in Physorev Letters, but it's limited in two ways. One is the molecule, since they were sort of thinking of more strongly correlated systems, the molecule is actually a one-site molecule, so they make it couples symmetrically to the left and right leads, but that's never going to be true for a realistic calculation, because if you had localized orbitals, each one would couple obviously differently to the left and to the right. But I don't think that's really a major limitation. And they also assume non-interacting leads, which almost everybody has to do. And here's the Euros, right? And including Robert van Leeuwen, have produced an exact interacting formula for time-dependent non-equilibrium Green's functions. So Robert is somebody who's been studying TD-DFT and non-equilibrium Green's function for many years, and there's a nice description of all this in the TD-DFT edited volume, the chapter on this has this formula, and Stefan has been wondering a lot of work, I think, especially recently. So they have a formalism whereby they sort of mapped it to a calculation in which you have a source on one side and a sink on the other, but you can define those objects essentially exactly, and using the non-equilibrium Green's functions, you can write down an exact expression for the current. But in those kinds of calculations, you know, and Stefan, I'm sure, is going to show some of them, right? You propagate in time, in real time, and you turn on the potential in real time and watch what happens. And lately, all sorts of interesting things have been happening, right, Stefan? The effect of bound states and things like that. I'm not going to go into any of that because I'm sure Stefan will. So this European collaboration, I should mention, right? So there's Hardy Gross, Angel Rubio, Stefan, and Ombla, and Gianluca Stefanucci were all involved, and people have been, I guess, coming and going, and it sort of spreads all over the place, right? People are attacking different aspects of the problem. Okay, so those were two easy ones, relatively easy ones. If standard models were correct, do popular functionals give the right answer? And you can fairly quickly convince yourself that the answer is no. You shouldn't expect them to. Because of what's been known for a long time, the derivative discontinuity in density functional theory. So, and this came up at one of our discussions a week or two ago. The position of the HOMO in a standard approximate calculation is in the wrong place. And if your levels are in the wrong place, and you're doing a resonant or an off-resonance tunneling calculation, that's going to cause a big error, having levels in the wrong place. And they also smear out resonance peaks due to the lack of the discontinuity. So in another sort of way, they cause trouble because if you think about the many body levels, the many body levels are very sharp in the sense that as you change particle numbers on a finite system, as you change particle numbers continuously in the sense of fractional particle numbers, you get sudden jumps in the Kohn-Sham potential at integer values of the number of electrons. And what that means is that these levels, the many particle levels that correspond to those, that LUMO, for example, doesn't kick in until you actually reach that level. But if you have an LDA or a GGA type calculation, it will occupy that level in a smooth and continuous fashion. And what that does is it smears out your resonance peaks. I'll show you little cartoons and so on. So this kind of ironic because the exact situation that was thought about in 1982, right, is a molecule or some system weakly coupled to a reservoir, and that's exactly what we have, except we've got two reservoirs, right? And so what happens is, as you vary, so here we think of, say, a hydrogen atom, or let's say helium plus, and here's a metal with some finite chemical potential, sufficiently low that only one electron is in our molecule, and we said a week or so ago that the HOMO is exactly equal to minus I in the Kohn-Sham system, right? So then we imagine just pouring in more electrons into the metal, and at some point the chemical potential gets high enough and you suddenly occupy the next level. But what happens is this entire Kohn-Sham potential rearranges itself so that that always this theorem is true, that the HOMO, which has now got one extra electron in it, so now the HOMO of the N plus 1 system is equal to minus
the electron affinity. And so what happens is, at that point, you get a sudden shift in the Pohn-Chow potential to make this still be exactly true, that this distance is the ionization potential of the system. This isn't very well drawn, this cartoon. And so it suddenly changes. Now, because it must give the exact density, this Kohn-Chow potential is the same as this one, except for a constant shift, because adding in one more particle, adding in an infinitesimal particle doesn't matter. Okay. So let me show a picture of it. You can easily make a picture for the hydrogen atom. This is because in the hydrogen atom, this is just minus 1 over R. The Kohn-Chow potential is, the exact Kohn-Chow potential is just minus 1 over R. And then you add in an infinitesimal amount of an electron, so you imagine this coupled to a reservoir, and it'll jump in such a way as to make sure that the HOMO is now equal to minus A rather than minus I. And so it was Max Kohn talking Ferdinand Evers who first began to notice that there were big differences between a DFT calculation and a Hartree-Fock calculation. This was just a calculation, I think, using TurboMol of within LDA is this curve here, and here's the Hartree-Fock, and you see that the Hartree-Fock is much sharper, and that's because it's an orbital-dependent theory, and so it has these sudden jumps as an orbital gets occupied, whereas a density functional, explicitly density functional theory, does not. And so you can see that here's the Fermi level. There's a huge difference, a couple of orders of magnitude between the transmission here and that calculation and that one. The resonances get much sharper when you calculate them better, and the smearing of the DFT, the approximate DFT calculations, gives you a much higher conductance of your off resonance. And this is a little picture where we show that later, and what's happening here this is the sharp feature, and this is what happens to it when it gets messed up by the DFT approximation, and it gets much narrower, broader. And then a little while later, with Stefano, we were able to demonstrate this effect. So you know that this is in there in your density functional calculation, and you know that you need to get your levels in the right place, and also that their behavior as a function of occupation must be right. And here is a calculation, it was a sort of simple model type calculation in which they offset the two electrodes so as to weaken the conduction on purpose. And you see here is, this is within a simplified model, but this is the LDA calculation, and this is with a self-interaction correction. And this is for the molecule that when it's weakly coupled to the things. And so when it's weakly coupled, these effects are very strong, and you see, especially at in the weak bias limit, there's a huge difference between the LDA conductance and the and when you turn on the self-interaction correction. On the other hand, when it's chemically bonded to the leads, if you haven't pulled the leads away, then you get almost perfect agreement. This effect is much weaker. So, and the question is, how much of this is in our, these standard calculations? You don't know, right? It doesn't mean that it's important or not, it says it could.
So Kieran, in this weakly coupled case, have you ever plotted the potential along this junction? I mean, where you have the left and then the molecule itself and then the right, meaning when you have the self, when you have this sick and the discontinuity, what you sometimes see are these bumps that build up, which kind of prevent the flow of charges. Right. Have you ever seen a plot of potential where you see these bumps?
I'll get to that. We actually went looking for that later, but it turned out that the way in which the self-interaction correction was done, we call it the poor man self-interaction correction, means that its response to the electric field is not accurate. It gives you these positions, both positions and widths, correctly for the sort of static problem and near weak bias limit, but it doesn't. Its potential is not accurate, we found out, by looking at molecules. I'm going to have a quiz if nobody asks me any questions, right? I mean, this stuff is not as trivial as I'm making it out to be. I have a quiz just for Matthias. So weak coupling, much lower conductance, and very little effect for when we have chemical bonding. And so our DFT calculations, we don't know how much of this effect is in there. Well, actually, Wei Tao Yang then after, and Harold Barringer did a chain of hydrogen atoms because that was all they could afford, about 100 hydrogen atoms, and had one special one in the middle, and tried to sort of test this effect by doing OEP calculations. And what they found was when they pulled the leads away, they got huge effects, and when it was chemically bonded, it was within a factor of 2. So it suggested that this was not the real reason, but this was a chain of hydrogen atoms, right? It was not dipyrrolate benzene.
I mean, do you know by chance of any calculation using hybrid functionals for transport to the molecule? Because they're...
Yes, they do. They do use them, and they still see... conductance is typically one or two orders of magnitude too small. Right? One way that people sort of have gotten around this problem in the intervening years is to look as a function of chain size, the number of repeating units in your molecule between the gold electrodes. And you can see the trend usually pretty well. The decay of the conductance is exponential. And you can calculate that number, and it's roughly given okay by DFT calculations. And that way, the prefactor doesn't matter, right? But we'll see that. Oh well, here we are, right? So this was the origin of our symbol on the wiki, right? This is this young guy Jeff Neaton, and I think we have Lantha is coming to the conference, right? Yeah, great. So these Colombians are at Columbia University. They have a MERSEC or whatever to really work on this problem. So Lantha is the experimental person, and Mark Heidrichsen has been doing lots of calculations, and Jeff Neaton is involved. And in fact, so their main thrust has been to do amide linkages instead of thiol linkages. And the reason that you do that is because you know much better where the molecule attaches to the gold. Although the binding is not as strong, it's much more specific to a given site. And that way, you have more confidence of sort of what's going on with the actual molecule and the electrodes. And so Jeff, this is this talk I heard about a month ago. So he applies two shifts from the GW calculations to what I call the standard model DFT calculations. One thing is he just uses the gas phase shift of the HOMO. For benzene, you know, there's a few eV shift of the HOMO, even in the gas phase. And then he also includes an image shift of the molecule on the surface. I think that's how it's done. And he gets general agreement within about 50%. So there's several nano letters he sent me over weekend describing what they're doing. Unfortunately, they're sort of nano letters, and so I couldn't quite get exactly. But the basic idea is it's a G-naught, W-naught type calculation. They run the DFT for the system, and then they do a one-shot on top of that. And I think all that happens is, you know, putting in these corrections just shifts the positions of the levels, basically. But I need to check that more generally. But if so, and then the one that he showed came out good to within 20% at that conference. So, you know, as long as everything is...
Just the sheep. He takes the sheep and you put in the regular Landauer model, and then it's okay.
Yes, but when we, I need to look at it more carefully because he's also doing a GW, calculation with a self energy in it, so I can't fully describe what he's doing. But the only inputs that are from outside his DFT calculation are these two. And each one, this one is bigger and this one is of the order of an EV. But when he does that, then his conductances go down, and agree much better with the experiments. And they've done a vast amount of work characterizing these experiments very well, doing vast numbers of averages and so forth to try to pin down all the effects. We'll see if it sort of holds up more generally. Yeah, I'll look a little more closely and see if I want my $20 back.
You want it within 20%, right? Or what was your...
Yeah, 20% was my criterion, but for one of the standard molecules, it came out within 17%.
Oh.
The recent paper they show that you get both the conductance and the beta, the decay with chain the size of the molecule very accurately within 50% for the actual conductance and within experimental error for the decay with the chain length. So whatever exactly it is they're doing, it seems to be working in the cases they've had so far.
So I have a question maybe. I remember a couple of years ago they had a gradient in the chemical potential across the junction, and they had to calculate that self-consistently. Is that still needed or not? In other words, it varied through the molecule.
That gets into some of the more subtle issues, right? I mean, certainly the Cohn-Sham potential is calculated self-consistently across the molecule, so you see steps, or rather, drops from one side to the other. I didn't bring any pictures of that kind of thing. But then you also have to worry about sort of differences between sort of electrostatic potentials and chemical potentials, right? And I don't have a sort of good feeling for that.
Is that an important issue? I mean, you somewhat sound as if this is not so important, or?
It's important in the sense that, you can ask, so this picture that we started with, right, doesn't make any sense in a certain, from a formal point of view, right? I mean, you don't have electronic systems with two chemical potentials. You only have one ever, right? So this picture is some thing that we made up in order to be able to think about this problem. Now, physically, it kind of makes sense. And it certainly made sense to Landauer, and he kind of figured out correctly. As I said, the Hartree effects seem to come in correctly, but when you analyze it more carefully with exchange and correlation, then it doesn't. But, I mean, to get back to this sort of question, I mean, you can do... Good morning, Julia. You can do... you can analyze it in the weak bias limit, but then you don't really shift the chemical potential, right? So you do zero temperature, weak bias, you do response theory. So any steps from one side to the other are infinitesimal, And as I said, we don't really have a general static theory for the entire many-body problem in which you would actually, you know, ask those kinds of questions, right? So people, discuss heavily, right, what happens as you to something like a chemical potential as you go from left to right, and it's a slightly ill-defined question, right? But what you can talk about is, say, the electrostatics and so forth, and within this weak bias limit. At least I haven't been able to. So that was a long way of saying I don't know.
Hmm? What you were describing a moment ago in Jeff's calculations when you said that the Kohn-Chan potential at least was calculated consistently.
Yes.
Is that a finite bias you're talking about there? And related question.
I believe so, yes.
The good conductance that you mentioned, is that specifically at zero bias or is it at all biases?
I wasn't checking for that when I was going through the... I don't know. But I'm sure it's in the papers. I just wasn't looking for it. I would guess it's the zero bias result. There was no discussion of peaks and so forth as a function of potential. So, but we need to look at them more carefully. Jeff says he's going to write a long paper. It should be ready in a couple of months. And maybe we could discuss possibly having him.
So, Kieran, yeah. This whole issue with one versus two chemical potentials, I thought this was addressed in this paper by Kamenev and Kohn. Which
we'll get
I
to
don't
that.
Understand very well, but this.
So we're just about to get to that. So the Kamenev-Kohn paper, though, again isn't that's just weak bias. So it avoids, let's say, the issue of that. Right? This is the end of the basic part. Right? And it's going to start getting kind of hairy. Okay, so... my phone came out. Okay, yeah. So now we're going to go to the trickier questions, which may or may not be relevant to much in the actual experimental situation. Is this Landauer formula right? And as I said, a place where we can look is this weak bias limit. And a way to think about it, a way to see how it works is to think of, first, just think of a molecule, a finite system, and you put it in the electric field. And you can write the change in the density three different ways, all of which will give you the same answer if you solve everything exactly, right? So people, you got to be a little careful. People name things differently in different fields, right? But I would call this the full many-body response function in the sense that this is the perturbation of the external potential, and it gives you the change in the density. So that this chi is the one we were talking about a few weeks ago. This is the full many-body chi, including reducible and irreducible pieces. Now, usually when you're doing many-body stuff, you talk about the proper susceptibility. So, and this it has got only the irreducible pieces, and this is defined so that when you apply the external potential plus the Hartree, it gives you the exact density response. But then, if you're doing density functional theory, you often look at the Kohn-Sham response function, as we were talking about when we were doing TDDFT and the exchange correlation. Then you have an exchange correlation contribution to this perturbing piece. And in principle, it gives you the exact density. So you can, and people do, think about the response in all three ways, right? So now let's imagine we're just doing zero frequency and you have, you know, your benzene and you're going to do your calculation and you're going to calculate the positions of the excitation energies and the oscillator strengths and the photoabsorption spectrum, say your Yabana and Birch, you know, 10 years ago or whatever, and you're sending this to JCP. And let's say you forget to include these exchange correlation pieces, right? Your answer will typically be off by of the order of 10% or so. If you don't, if you just did the external and the Hartree pieces. And if the referee isn't asleep, he should reject, he or she should reject it for JCP because it's not accurate and it isn't the right answer for your problem, right? So this is just static electric response, right? When you resolve what you're doing, so you just take the molecule, put on an electric field, ask how the density changes, ask how the dipole moment changes to get its polarizability. So if you do it as a function of frequency, you can see the optical response if you're doing TDDFT, or just a static response, the dipole and the polarizability, you have to include this or you make a mistake. Make it all again. Now I'm just going to change the characters here. But we're going to have the same set of equations but written in a slightly different way. And this is with the current in terms of the electric field. So this is the same basic equation as our first one here, except instead of looking in terms of the density, I look in terms of the change in the current, and instead of the potential, I look at the electric field. So this is the conductivity, and in general it'll be a tensor, but that won't matter for what we want to do. So this is the change in the current density in response to an external electric field. And here I've made it independent of R prime because we want a uniform electric field on our system. And then if we have the full many-body one, we can get rid of the ring, the bubble diagrams, and this is the proper piece in response to the real. So this is now the real electric field, we would call it, because it's got the Hartree and the external pieces, and then in Cohn-Chan, DFT, you have this exchange correlation electric field. So this in principle gives you the exact answer, and then you can analyze what does your, you know, how does it compare to Landauer, right? So you have to do a little bit of work, and the work was basically done in this Cohn-Kamenev paper, but actually the piece that we're going to use goes back to Barringer and Stone, and Barringer told me it goes back beyond that too. So you have to sort of very carefully think about this limit, that's all, and the derivation gets a little lengthy and stuff, that's not worrying about that. But basically you're using Cohn-Sham quantities, right, and trying to extract the many-body response. And here actually is the thing that basically comes out of this Kamenev-Cohn paper. So to do this properly, you have to take limits very, very carefully because there are many different length scales in this problem. I don't know why these X's are here. But here's a list of some of them. And in particular, so the way you think about it is you turn on the electric field at a finite frequency, and so the electrons, so when you turn it on, they sort of sweep backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards, and each time they're sort of going through the barrier, so if you calculate, this will tell you what the sort of response is. And in particular, I can't remember what I called this because it didn't seem to have a name in the literature, but this excursion length is the distance traveled by a Fermi electron during one period of the external field if it were free. And so if you have long clean leads, you have to make sure that this excursion length is longer than any other length scale in the problem interacting, you know, like the screening length and so forth, but then shorter than the size of your system and other length scales. And so this is how you take the zero frequency limit in order to get the right answer. And I guess Rex talked about this quite a lot, right, over the last few years, in terms of finite size calculations and the orders of these limits. Okay, so when you do that very carefully, right, and so you're going to take the zero frequency limit, don't worry about any of that. What happens is that you get a very, very simple answer for this conductivity. And now there's a very subtle point going on here, which is, what is the response function, right? This is the DC response that you want to get, right? So that's almost a static property, but it isn't quite, right? You take the frequency down to zero, and as the frequency goes to zero, this excursion length gets longer and longer, and this thing becomes independent of R and R prime, the conductivity, and it's just one, comes out to be just one number, and very nicely is exactly the transmission. This is for non-interacting particles, it's the transmission at the Fermi energy, which is what you expected it to be. Then it's consistent with the Landauer-Budiger thing, except, right? This is just going through what happens as you go down to zero frequency, and you get this, that this is the current. So because this thing becomes independent of position, it just pops out front, and then this is just the integral of the electric field contributions, so that's just the potential drop. Except there's this extra little character here, this VXC, the exchange correlation potential drop across the device. This is the real potential drop, and this is the exchange correlation piece. And that is missing in the Landauer formula. So you're possibly missing some key exchange correlation contributions to the current. You don't know for sure that you're missing them. They look like they ought to be there, but until you can calculate them, you don't know that they might turn out to be zero for some mysterious reason, right? One of those mystical gifts of density functional theory. But if you just do the analysis at exactly the same level as putting a molecule in an electric field, they're there, and they're missing here, right? And this makes sense. Because Landauer, was doing his stuff before DFT was invented, right? Or at least Cohn Chan DFT. Seven.
Just a remark here. You talk about the steady state limit.
The what?
The steady state.
Yes, I'm talking about extracting.
Now, if you have our little friend VXC there, there might not be a steady state. Just a remark. I will talk about this.
Yes, exactly. Yes, thank you. So I'm only talking about the case where there is a steady state. The Landauer formula, as far as we know, it's designed just for steady. It doesn't mean it doesn't tell us anything if it's not steady, but. That's the only case I'm talking about. So what does this mean, right? So this paper that Max Kohntop wrote had about six different things in it, and so they often get very confused, right? So if this drop for some, if it's not zero, then there are corrections, the Landauer thing, right? Typically at the 10 or 20% level, but in this problem, you don't know. They could shift peaks around and all sorts of things. You don't really know a priori how big they would be. But then there are these missing terms, right? And there's two possible types in the sense that you could imagine, especially Vx, if there is a step. So these things are the net effect of the electric field as we go. So here's our molecule region, and here's our leads. and these V's, I should really write them as delta V's. So so you see that there's a change, let's say, in the Hartree. So they're all the response V's. So let me call it VH. And if there is a net change in the exchange correlation potential, so if there's also some step which would actually be in the reverse direction and the exchange correlation potential, then you've missed something. And that might even show up in a static OEP calculation. And that's what I was referring to, that Stefano and I, that's why we're testing his SIC on molecules in response to electric field, and it turns out it's not accurate enough to give you the good response characteristics. You have to do sort of full OEP SIC, and Stefan Kummel showed that in order to get. So actually, that's a very important result that a lot of, you know, when I started working on this, people didn't know. People really didn't know what the answer was. We all believe that the self-interaction correction gives us much better levels in our calculation. It, you know, fixes a lot of the errors in the levels. But the question was, if you look at how the levels change in response to the electric field, does it work as well? Because if you take a long chain polymer, we know that LDAs and GDAs way overpolarize a long chain conjugated polymer. And if you do an OEP calculation or even a Hartree-Fock calculation, you get these bits of the exchange potential that oppose the applied field and make it polarize much less. And this has been around for a long time. And it's related to the GGG stuff, right? And there's one of the G's of solids and electric fields. But anyway, so you could imagine that you get some contributions here, and also dynamic that show up as the zero frequency limit of something like a time-dependent current DFT calculation. Because to write down these equations, you do it in terms of the current instead of the density, it kind of comes out much more naturally in terms of time-dependent current DFT. But you can translate from one to the other and write things in terms of the kernel DFT.
But those two additive distinct things, or are they just different sides of the same coin?
That's a subtle question, right? So recently, I guess in the last 4 or 5 months or something, there was a paper by Deventra and Vignale sort of revisiting this issue. And, well, they've done several things, but they claim to have shown that there are none of these adiabatic corrections, that they're all dynamic. But I think you have to be extremely careful because of the, this is what causes all the problems in the DFT applied to the solids as well, is the interchange of omega going to zero and Q going to zero, right? As we know, right? It's quite a subtle issue. And so I think you might, they might be two sides of the same coin, and in order to figure out what side you're looking at, you have to be really, really careful, right? And so the basic thing here is, in fact, I'm fairly confident they are two sides of the same coin. The basic thing is, as far as I can tell, is that since you're looking at going towards zero frequency, it's not that different from a ground state calculation, right? At least in on the zero bias limit.
Depends on what your ground state system is, whether it has a gap or whether it's metallic. Right? It depends on how you go with respect to the single particle excitation spectrum.
The behavior will depend on that, exactly. And in terms of the things we were discussing, I think last week, in the sense, as far as you can apply the concepts, this is a bad metal, right? Because it's got a pretty big defect in it, namely the molecule, right? But anyway, so an interesting thing is that it's the net change, it's the change from one side to the other. So if you have a local approximation or a GGA, I'm not sure if you have a hybrid, you may not, certainly for LDA and GGA, you don't have any net change in the exchange correlation potential from one side to the other. So within those, you know, if you're happy doing that kind of calculation, you don't have to worry about this. It is zero. But, of course, if it's really there, then you have a problem.
So what happens if you have a piece of Hartree-Fock exchange? I mean, what if you have a hybrid functional, if you, there at least a long tail of the Hartree-Fock exchange?
I don't know, because as far as I can tell, nobody's ever looked. But also, you know, things get very hairy when you're mixing the Hartree-Fock with cone channels, right? But I would expect this effect to show up, basically, because you have a quarter of it.
Of course, it's possible to formulate the response function theory, not in DFT at all, but in time-dependent Hartree-Fock or something beyond that, in anybody.
Yes, absolutely.
And as always, you pay the price for having to deal with quantities that have more indices on them.
Yes.
But you gain by not having these very long range, somewhat sort of physical aspects.
Silly effects, exactly. Yes, that you're then trying to deal with your density functional, exactly. But I can't see any reason why, if you take a long chain molecule and you put in an electric field and your density functional calculation way over polarizes it, that effect won't show up in this kind of system. And therefore, and we know in that case, if you do a more intelligent calculation like Hartree-Fock even, you get these, you know, it polarizes much better, it doesn't over polarize half as much. That suggests that these terms should be there. So likely corrections is this adiabatic piece and dynamic. So in Max de Venter's group, Nassai used the Vignale cone approximation to estimate this and found small but finite corrections. But actually, the Vignale cone is derived in the high frequency limit, and there are very good reasons to think that it might not be accurate here. And then they also missed some other terms. And Rex, were you on that comment, I think? Yeah. I didn't have time to look at that. So the role of time-dependent DFT. So TDDFT does not strictly apply because the system is infinite. Theorems are only proven for the finite case. I don't know if that's a problem, but you have to be very careful. Even not worrying about that, you need a zero-frequency long wavelength response. So you have all the problems due to locality that we've been discussing before, you know, that you're missing the 1 over Q squared piece. There's no reason for the Vignale cone approximation to be accurate. The Vignale cone approximation is the most commonly used attempt to go beyond adiabatic LDA, at least in solid state physics. But it's a gradient expansion. It's a straight gradient expansion in the time-dependent case. And again, to derive it, you really need the current theory. But it's just a straight gradient expansion. And we know in the ground state case that gradient expansions, without generalizing or anything like that, don't work very well in most cases. And in particular, this thing has been tested in lots of sort of finite systems and doesn't work. I mean, it probably doesn't have the right physics. It has the physics of a weakly perturbed metal. And I don't know if anybody has tried this nanoquanta kernel. Where's Patrick? For this problem, right? And whether or not it would, what effects it would build in or not build in. Has anybody?
Well, I don't know the answer to the question, but the key thing about the nanoquantum kernel is that it avoids the problems in the FT that are due to the main things that you're discussing here, which is the derivative discontinuities.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, start by doing the one particle corrections using many body perturbation theory, GW, for example.
Yes.
And only then does it go back to DFT for doing the beta cell keto.
Right.
So I'm not saying it would be perfect, but I think it should be a big step forward on top of relative to LDA or keto.
Right. So if but what you've got to do the GW first, right? That's so I guess so. If young Jeff Neaton's results hold up, right, then it's a strong suggestion. And he's been doing it kind of by cutting and pasting and stuff, right? But if he's basically got the right physics by doing that, it's a strong suggestion that this would take care of a lot of things. Yeah. Oh my God. I'm the chair, it doesn't matter. So there's one more, but this is hard. So I don't know. We should have a vote. Do we want to hear about this or not? Well, you still got 20 minutes to lunch. I just have a quick summary.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, that's really kind of quick, right? But sort of, you know, So you know, people have been, you know, thinking and working on it, you know, and for a long time now. And these are two of the main things, right? So real, as I mentioned, real-time non-equilibrium Green's functions. By the Europeans, and then Roberto and I and various other people were developing this TDDFT for open quantum systems. So these are two quite different ways to go after the problem. But the basic problem is, you know, how can you construct a scheme where you can do accurate calculations on chemically realistic systems, right? And many of you have seen this, so, you know, in order to get around a lot of the issues, and in order to do it with plain wave code, which is primary motivation as far as I can tell, because that's what Roberto uses, you put the whole thing on a ring and thread through a solenoid with a magnetic field, and if this is time varying, it gives you a static electric field everywhere on the ring. And it doesn't mess up the periodic boundary conditions. But you've changed the gauge. But you know, it's just a gauge change, so everything should be fine. But when you do that, you notice, if you start doing this in real time, that the electrons start going around faster and faster and faster, because this is a weak metal. It will accelerate, and so then you put in this, we constructed this master equation with coupling to a bath, nominally, as it turns out, in phonons, which will produce a steady state within this ring. And so we had hoped originally to get the coupling from real phonons, right? But then we remembered that we need about 5,000 angstroms of actual real metal in order to do that. So that has taken a lot of time of Roberto's trying to figure this out, right? So basically, so actually while we're here, we're supposed to finish this mammoth paper that we've been writing for I don't know how many years. In which we go through all the details of this procedure, because there's an awful lot of them. But anyway, so it has evolved, and now you can by a careful limiting process, find the sort of the gamma goes to zero, the coupling goes to zero limit of these calculations, and you have to, you know, it's quite tricky, but you do it as a function of the size of the ring and so forth. And there's lots and lots of kind of very fundamental issues between current, you know, this Hamiltonian evolution and this dissipative evolution. But here were some, well, this was had recent calculations in the last 2 years or so, where, but they went back and did dithiolated benzene in a pretty small cell, but these are pretty expensive calculations at the moment. And they end up with, you know, conductances comparable to the Landauer formula. After all, this worked, right? But I mean, that, of course, it's very important that it recovers the Landauer formula. So it's recovering it in a completely different way. The physics is completely different because here you're really doing it essentially at finite temperature and going at zero temperature. And then you can use the, and here's the drop in the potential across the molecule, and you see that it doesn't quite, you can't actually draw potentials, strictly speaking, for the system because it's in this different gauge, but you can kind of reverse engineer them out. This is a periodic system, yet somehow there's potential, right? Doesn't matter on the other side. There is no potential to describe it.
Is anything there at all sensitive to the way in which you put in the dissipation?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so you have to very carefully get down to the zero dissipation limit. And so, and you know, as you try to make the coupling smaller, right, you've got to make the ring bigger, because if the coupling is smaller, then it's doing the dissipation. It has to kind of basically lose all its phase information in one cycle of the ring. So, yes, it is sensitive, but, and, you know, I guess these haven't appeared yet, you know, but you do the sequence of calculations of different ring sizes and you can pull out. So at one point you may have seen they were doing calculations with gold wires and using that to find the dissipation that recovered the Landauer formula. That's gone now. By this procedure, we get the zero coupling limit. But of course, by getting the zero coupling limit, right, we've created a very expensive way to do this calculation, right? If that's all you do it for. Stefan?
I was wondering essentially the same thing. I mean, you have to put in the dissipation in order to get a steady state current in the first place, no?
Right.
Now, this dissipation mechanism in Landauer isn't necessary at all to get
a
steady state current. So,
yes.
But it's implicit in there, isn't it, in the Landauer formula? It's implicit that the electrons eventually equilibrate when they're very far from the center.
Well, but it's not any sort of dissipation mechanism in the sense of vibrations or something. I mean, it's a purely electronic effect, and it's purely, as you said at the very beginning of your talk, purely due to the zero spacing between single particle levels. So, it's a continuum.
Yes.
If you wish.
So, I mean, from sort of that point of view, this is simply a different way of getting the same thing with periodic boundary conditions. As I said, you take the coupling to zero and you get the zero coupling limit, which ought to be the same, and that's in paper from 57 by Cohen and Luttinger.
Well, Landauer is not really zero coupling limit. I mean, in the sense that it doesn't have a bath, but okay, maybe.
These are just orders of limits in the sense that if this didn't give the same answer, right? I mean, it's fundamentally has to give the same answer in this limit, but then it's given the same answer, right? I mean, so I think your point
What I'm wondering is if you do the zero coupling limit and you have your finite field, I mean, then your current blows up.
No, because we always take, it's an infinitesimal coupling, right? And then we're always fine. It's the same as the eta in the Kubo response formula. You can't set eta to zero, but as long as you make eta small enough that things don't depend on it anymore, then you get the right answer. It's the same basic thing, but being achieved in a completely different way. So what I think, you know, in that language, what I'm saying is that if anything we get depends on the coupling, right? Then it's something different from so the fact that you can get the steady state by just having infinite leap. This is another way of getting the same quantum mechanics with finite leaps, but on periodic boundary conditions.
So this is not specific coupling of, let's say, the acoustic phonons to the electrons. It is not.
Okay, so this kind of thing is not, but it does, at least in principle, allow you to put in specific coupling to specific phonons. And, you know, Roberto is working on that kind of stuff all over the place.
Because all of the IETs, you know, the inelastic electron
timing,
yes, spectroscopy, it shows that there are only very specific modes. I mean, you don't have to take all the phonons.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, there are very specific modes that couple.
Right. And in fact, in these calculations, I mean, only the back, only the metal has the dissipation turned on. But it should be possible to couple to the localized phonons, you know, let's say localized modes in the molecule, and take that into account explicitly. And I guess Roberto is working on a thing where, I mean, within tight binding, but taking, you know, huge nanotubes and looking at the difference between what you call it, ballistic, the transition between ballistic and what's the other type of transport, diffusive transport, right? And so this machinery should be, in a certain sense, ideal for that. So it's, you know, but at the moment it's expensive to run, right? Let's not worry about any of this stuff. But yeah, this is the thing about the, right? So this is at the heart of the issue you're raising, Stefan, right? We get the isothermal conductivity instead of the adiabatic conductivity. So this is in the language of bulk materials, but so yeah, this is like a finite temperature calculation taken down to zero, whereas this is one in which you ignore the temperature, which is all fine, at least within Kubo response, because the Joule heating and so forth is a higher order effect. On the other hand, our thing allows you to actually look at the heating within the molecule, but given the state of our coupling, it's not clear how you know, how realistic that is. And if you compare with some of the experiments, it's hard to tell what's really going on.
So what's the quantity that you should be comparing with experiment?
Well, the IV characteristic, right? I mean, at the moment.
But when you make the difference between adiabatic and isothermal.
Yes.
Is this, so what is the quantity that is measured?
Basically, it's the isothermal conductivity, right? Because you can never truly turn off the phonons in your sample, right? But in doing response theory, you can show that that's the same as the adiabatic conductivity, and that's what's actually calculated almost all the time, right?
At zero temperature. So if you have
I think even at finite temperature, as long as you occupy things.
Finite temperature, just from temperature where they do the measurements.
Yes.
And you do a calculation and you get the adiabatic conductivity. Is this a quantity that has a one-to-one correspondence to what they measure?
Yes. Within Kubo response, yes, they're the same. You can show that they give you the same answer. And this is, that's what I mentioned, this paper, Cohn and Luttinger in 1957. Demonstrate this. I mean, you just do response theory and you find that thing. But that's only within leading order, so in our case it's weak bias. If you go to the second order, you get the Joule heating, which is in this, but it's not in that. So, And recently, Max Leventer has come up with a variation on this stochastic TDDFT. And so this is more in this sort of dissipative type way that, you know, people do calculations. So you can take this stochastic Schrodinger equation, so a time-dependent Schrodinger equation that has random jumps in it in the potential, and you can design one that whose average density follows the master equation. And so Deventer and Agassi have suggested applying the Kohn-Chan treatment directly, the time-dependent Kohn-Chan treatment, to that, rather than the master equation. And this will, I'm pretty sure, lead to sort of different approximations. So a different way of using sort of stochastic theory to address these kinds of issues. And other people have been able to use it. Yeah. Okay, right. Steady state is achieved by having a continuum purely electronic. We have this dissipation, but as I said, as the coupling goes to zero, it gives the same. This is a finite system with sinks and sources, right? We have periodic boundary conditions, there the density, here we have the current density. And actually, one thing to watch out for is Roberto swears and curses when we had to do this calculation, because all your codes are designed at best to give densities accurately. And if you have any kind of basis set, which you do, even if it's plane waves, you discover that continuity is violated because the basis set is not complete. And so then everywhere in your code, you have to go back and put in the corrections in order to make it satisfied to see all these things right. They both allow non-steady processes, but the things I've shown you are just for finding the steady result, right? We could also do real-time evolution, but we don't. This doesn't have any dissipation of presence, but since it's based on many by hearing and so forth, you can always put in the coupling to the phonons. Slightly new functional is needed. How new? I don't know, right? Obviously, in the limit where the coupling goes to zero, you don't need something, but otherwise you don't. Okay, so I'm going to. Do we know how the steady current arises? Yes. We don't really have an exact Landau formula. I guess we have a time dependent one, but do we have something that's exact for the steady case? Are the standard functionals good enough? No. And now the Jeff's work also suggests that. In the limit of weak bias, is the standard model correct? No. There's missing exchange correlation pieces. We need these corrections if they're important, but they're also highly non-local, so you might be waiting quite a while. But maybe the nanoquanta kernel combined with GW can do it. And what is the best approach to the general problem? Yeah. Various people are working on it in various different directions. So let's thank Kieran for a very kind time.
I only have the $12 bill for you.
I haven't decided on my $20. Well, I mean, having lost one already, I'm very cautious, right? Now, so I haven't actually decided on my challengers yet. And actually, I put a little response to your challenge. I wanted a better definition of the challenge.
Yeah, well, the question really is, which is the most serious problem there?
Well, that's kind of interesting. As I was going through this, right, and all these things I've worried about and thought about for all these years, right, you know, it seems like if you get the levels, yeah. And actually, I have two projects ongoing that are very consistent with this, let's say, but we haven't got to the end yet, so I don't know exactly how to plan. But, you know, by doing DFT, maybe with shifting levels around to be in the right places and not being too broad, you seem to do pretty good, despite all these other fears and concerns and so forth. So the projects I'm working on now ask sort of the question, how far can you get with ground state DFT? And there's one point I wanted to make, which I used to make years ago and have stopped, but Hardy Gross still makes it, but it's wrong. I'll tell you why it's wrong, it's important. So Hardy will tell you that you go back all the way to this, when you see these sharp features, right? When the homo, the lumo comes in to the window, and you say, aha, here's an unoccupied level, I'm gonna bump at the current, right? And then I started off saying, if I do TD-DFT, I know that these unoccupied Cohn-Sham levels are wrong, right? They're not the true excitations of a molecule. They get corrected by TD-DFT. We all know that they're not the real excitation, right? So then this is wrong, right? Because this is a lumo and it's been moved in, and it can't be right. Well, it turns out that so far I've only shown that I haven't gone through all the details to make sure it's completely correct, but as sure as that looks like it. And there are many body calculations that basically confirm this. If you think, so how can that be? But you never actually see the unoccupied level. You think you do, but you don't. All you ever measure, and at least in the weak bias limit, is the transmission of the Fermi energy. And all those pictures I showed you, so if you just have the steady system and you just look at the Fermi energy, so there's some unoccupied level higher up in energy, right? But if you only do weak bias, you can't see that. It's there in your calculation, but it's not there in your experiment. Your experiment only measures the Fermi energy. But if you put on a gate voltage and you can do that onto one of these molecules, you can shift the molecular levels up and down. It's tricky and you got a screen and stuff, but you can basically move them up and down. And this is what they do when they see these diamonds, right? So you shift the levels down. And so that way you can put on a gate voltage and shift that unoccupied level onto your Fermi energy and then see the bump in the current. And you do see it. But when you do that, when you make that shift, you're shifting the number of electrons on your molecule, right? By putting on the gate voltage, it's coming down and suddenly more levels are being occupied. And because so then your charge density is actually changing. And that changes your Cohn-Sham potential. So then what looked like the lumo that wasn't occupied, as it comes down, starts changing. And in fact, you can show that under very reasonable circumstances, it's a ground state property. And that would tell you that these peaks and things like that are given exactly by doing the transmission through the Cohn-Sham potential. And there's a paper from start of last year, I think, by a collaborator of mine, Ferdinand Evers, in many body theory, where they take a simple model and they do DMRG, density matrix renormalization group theory, and the postdoc was very good and figured out how to get the conductance out of that. And they show, even with strongish correlation, that the transmission through the system, given by just straight transmission through the Cohn-Sham potential, is very close to the DMRG value.
If you have the exact Cohn-Sham potential.
Yeah, but ground state Cohn-Sham potential.
Yeah. But it still needs to be a damn good function.
Not for the weak bias limit. I mean,
LDA won't do the job.
Well, that was what I was talking about at the start, right? And the levels and things, and you have self-interaction in there. But, to know that you could get it from the ground state thing would be, I think, pretty helpful.
Actually, I'm really confused. So are you saying that this is related to the ground state of the negatively charged molecules, that is, to the electron affinity?
Exactly.
But then there are functionals that will not get for you the electron affinity.
Right? Oh, yes. Yeah. No, I'm not.
There are cases in which, that's...
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It depends. I mean, you...
Yeah, I'm not saying you're going to get away your usual common functionals. So what I'm saying is... then you know what you're aiming for. Right?
So if you have a functional which gives for you know, which provides you with a decent electron affinity for your molecule, then you get it with the ground state calculation.
Yeah, and actually for this purpose, something like OEP would work just fine, because OEP will give you bad electron affinities because the energetics miss the correlation, and correlation is quite substantial for an electron affinity of an atom, say. But it does bind the negative ion, and it puts the orbitals in about the right place.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would immediately tell you that OEP ought to do it, kind of thing. And again, maybe these, you know, sort of GW-type calculations might be sort of consistent with that. Depends exactly on what he's doing, right? So, I guess a small seminar room at 2 o'clock and somebody else can talk.